Is there any truth to the perception that the left is funny and the right isn't?
I think there is truth to that, yes.
How have politically engaged organizations used the web to fundamentally change how people organize and engage politically? Why are left-wing organizations more likely to succeed an organization online? And why are conservatives less funny than liberals? In 1998, at the height of the congressional effort to impeach President Bill Clinton, software entrepreneurs Joan Blades and Wes Boyd started an email list centered around a petition encouraging Congress to drop the case, to effectively move on. Since 1998, the organization MoveOn.org has gone on to fuel hundreds of progressively themed campaigns, petitions, and even candidacies, and fundamentally changed how political advocacy works. David Karpf chronicles MoveOn.org and the dozens of similar Netroots political organizations, both progressive and conservative, that have sprouted up with the mass adoption of the internet in his new book, The MoveOn Effect: The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy. On this 2012 election-themed episode of Radio Berkman, he speaks with our host, David Weinberger, about how these organizations are having an impact on politics.
The subtitle to Clay Shirky's first book, Here Comes Everybody, is The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. What the MoveOn Effect is about is actually a modification of that, that I think the much bigger impact is coming today through organizing with different organizations. And what I mean by that is that we see a generation shift from the groups like MoveOn.org, really groups that were founded 1998 and later, and the older, what I call legacy groups, that are still with us today, but were built in a different time. And the big differences between the old groups and the new groups come down to what I call membership and fundraising regimes. So MoveOn has about 7 million different members. However, if you ask people first, do you receive MoveOn's emails, and you ask them to raise their hands, and then you ask them how many of you are members of MoveOn, most of those hands will go down. So it's actually not very well known amongst their email-receiving public that if you receive a MoveOn email, that makes you a member. The organization has simply redefined membership because they can, because technology makes it possible in a way that it wasn't before. The membership regime that we had prior to MoveOn was sort of the armchair activism model, in which membership was you write a check to an organization once a year, and that organization then sends you a lot of mail saying, hey, will you write us more checks, please? That older model of membership was one in which there wasn't a very strong relationship between the member and the organization. There wasn't a lot of communication going on, but that direct mail funding allowed organizations starting in the late 60s, early 1970s, to build large infrastructure, mostly in Washington, D.C. They could hire policy specialists, lobbyists, and they could use that to try to make policy gains around whatever single issue they were based around. So that's how you get an environmental movement, a women's movement, all separate from one another. And what we see is since the founding of MoveOn.org, and particularly in the past 12 years, what we've seen instead is a rise of internet-mediated issue generalists. So these are groups that are mostly working on whatever issue is in the news this past week. So what we're seeing is a change in how organizations define membership, how they interact with those members, and how they engage in activism and what they engage in activism around, which at the end of the day, I think has larger and bigger staying power than the simple organizing without organizations that you see through things like e-petitions or Twitter mobilization. It's not that e-petitions and Twitter mobilization aren't important, but if you're trying to build power and engage in collective action, really change big political conversations, then what you need to do is get organized and be able to fight over the longer term. And when we see things like Occupy Wall Street move past the first few months into the first few years, what we see is them developing some form of organization.
So this makes it very hard to situate on a scale. It's hard to know what scale to use. So one of the ways of thinking about this is that the old style associations, and this is a hypothesis for you to react against, that old style associations, the sense of membership was stronger and far stronger than the other type of organization, in this case, organization without an organization, as you say, a Twitter campaign. a Twitter campaign has no sense of identifying with an organization? And is it that in between those two, there's something like there's the MoveOn and other such organizations?
Yeah, so I would say what groups like MoveOn do is they engage in what I call sedimentary mobilization, which is you'll do a Twitter campaign or you'll do an e-petition, which can go viral. But what makes them an organization rather than organizationless is that when that issue recedes, you are left with the sediment of a member list that you can contact in the future. And if you can't contact them in the future, then that means that your opponents just need to weather the storm, and then, okay, it's gone. Don't worry anymore. So these new organizations are defining membership as anyone who took an action once, and now we can reach out to them again. The interesting thing, and I should note, there's a third definition of membership there, which if listeners are on college campuses, they're actually very well acquainted with. On college campuses, we've got extracurricular groups where membership is still the very old style of membership of showing up. Membership prior to around the 1960s, this is based on research by a Harvard professor, Theda Scotchball, called Diminished Democracy. But prior to the 1960s, membership was still like the Rotary Clubs or the Elks Clubs, where being part of the group meant you were a Rotarian, you were an Elk. You showed up to meetings, you eventually became the treasurer, or if you were really unlucky, you ended up being the secretary. I always recommend to people that they should avoid being the secretary, by the way. But we still see that on college campuses today, where membership is showing up. And in the 70s, we went from membership is showing up to membership is writing checks. And now we've gone from membership is writing checks to membership as I'm on your list. The kind of surprising thing there is, even though membership continues to get thinner and thinner, there's actually some strength to this new MoveOn style membership that wasn't there in the armchair activism days. And that's because groups like MoveOn engage in rigorous A-B testing. Any message that they send out to the full list, they first send two versions of it to random segments of the list. And through that A-B testing, they get what I call passive democratic feedback. So they're able to find out what issue topics are most popular with their members, what issue frames are most popular, what actions they're willing to take, what they're willing to do, in a way that the older single issue groups never could. Because we've moved to a richer information environment and one with lower transaction costs, even though membership today is thinner, the organizations that employ this new notion of membership are able to hear much better from their membership than the groups that came before them.
If you take the two new ways in which we are organizing, either without an organization or with a very different sort of organization, on the one hand, you have, say, a Twitter movement in which people change their photos to a green tint to declare solidarity with a cause, an action that doesn't have any direct outcome, I assume. You take that and you take the MoveOn model. What are each good at? Are there things that the Twitter movement, the Twitter campaign is better at than MoveOn?
So groups like MoveOn move much faster than the older groups that are their peers today, but they don't move as fast as Twitter does. And so what we see with the organizing without organizations that I think it's particularly good at is kind of meme surfing or producing memes. So if we think in the U.S. case, during the Republican National Convention, there was that great speech given by Clint Eastwood where he yelled at a chair. And immediately we saw two things happen on Twitter that were totally unorganized. One was a new account called Invisible Obama got set up and started tweeting funny things. And another was the hashtag Eastwooding, which people spent about a week sort of playing around with. The most retweeted message during the entire RNC was the Obama campaign weighing in with Eastwooding with a chair that said president on the back of it, Obama's chair, and it said that this chair is taken. And that got retweeted all over the place. And the thing that ends up being important for is that some of the people engaging in Eastwooding are also the reporters who are covering the convention. So that meme itself becomes news and helps drive the news agenda. And then it also creates an opportunity for organizations to take to capture. So these new organizations that are engaging what I call headline chasing, the disorganized activity on Facebook and Twitter can signal to them, here's an opportunity. Here's somewhere that you can go and try to weigh in and organize power or find supporters. But the distinction there is we're not going to overthrow governments or achieve policy goals by changing our Twitter avatars to be slightly green. What we are going to do is signal to the media and signal to organizations that this is something to come pay attention to, because look at all the people who have taken this one solidarity act. Maybe they'll take later acts. Part of this goes back to some very old traditions in political organizing, which is that in order to succeed in political organizing, there's an old notion of power that dates back to Robert Dahl, which defines power as A has power over B to the extent that A can get B to take an action that B would not have taken otherwise. And if we use that notion of power, then a single e-petition or a single Twitter action tends not to be very powerful directly. And that's because it's only in the rarest of possible circumstances that networks of powerful people, of influential people, are going to do something other than what they would have done anyways because they saw a petition. And the cases where we're going to see that are cases where, for instance, we saw in cultural activism that occasionally a television show will get saved because of an e-petition or because of Twitter outbursts. And that's sort of because the elites who are making that decision are saying, well, we want to only keep this thing in the air if there's really strong support. And then you go and demonstrate really strong support and they say, okay, we'll give it to you. You're not going to get Mitt Romney to reveal his taxes through an e-petition, because that's something where he clearly really doesn't want to. There have been other efforts to do so. And so if you want to get him to do that, if you want to get Walmart to allow unions to organize, one example that I use in the book is the Wisconsin labor protests from March 2011. What you want to do is convince the Wisconsin State Senate to change their budget rescissions bill and convince the governor to take a different action. That's going to take organizing. It's going to take long-term organizing. And so sort of the key point here is it's not that the internet isn't also useful for that. It's that different capacities of the internet are particularly useful for those actions.
One of the things that the Twitter campaign lets happen that the MoveOn style does not is that we can see each other. Tinting your avatar green may not have any effect on the people you want it to affect, but it does on your followers. You can see who, in fact, it's like putting on a T-shirt or a bumper sticker or a lawn sign. What can or does MoveOn and MoveOn style groups do to create that sense of community and solidarity?
Oh, one of the things they do is engage with those memes. So in the midst of Eastwooding, we had groups like DailyCoast.com, which is a big political blog, but functions as an advocacy group as well. They endorse candidates. They focus on issues. They fundraise for the candidates they endorse. They even have an annual in-person convention. So groups like DailyCoast and MoveOn, what we'll see is in the midst of those mass solidarity moments that are sort of viral moments, they're not planned by anyone, those groups will go and engage with them. So they'll also be putting out Eastwooding photos, or they'll also be retweeting messages that people are putting out there that are showing that solidarity. And through that, since those are organizations with very large followings, they're then also helping those messages to spread. Because if you've got a bumper sticker on your car, but your car is sitting in the garage, then it's not being communicated to anyone. Whereas if you're driving through traffic, then it's going to get seen more. And the same way on the social media environment, somebody who's got 5 followers on Twitter, when they change their avatar to be green, well, 5 people at most are going to see that. Whereas if they've got 5 followers, but one of those followers is MoveOn and it gets retweeted, well, then we have tens of thousands who are then exposed to that message.
So is this distributed evenly across the political spectrum?
It is not. And that's one of the things, I turned to this in chapter 6 of the book. It's actually kind of a mystery, because right-wing organizations have tried and failed continually to build their own MoveOn.org. They often cite it by name, saying the latest one was 2 years ago, a group called Liberty.com got launched, and they said, we are going to be the MoveOn.org of the right. And we've seen several of those organizations throughout the first decade of the 21st century. naming move on and saying, we're going to go do that. And what usually happens is that the organization will announce its intentions and get a news story in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And then you wait about 8 months and you check back, and there will be another story in the Washington Post and the New York Times talking about how that group failed. So I set out in the book to try to figure out why that is. And in particular, there's two broad explanatory narratives, one of which is what I call ideological coherence, that there's something about the internet and its end-to-end architecture which just fits better with the left. And the other is what I call out-party innovation incentives, that being the party out of power yields a better set of opportunities for taking advantage of new technology. They're not mutually exclusive, but what I argue in the book is that the reason why there's no right-wing MoveOn is more an out-party story, and the reason why there's no real right-wing equivalent of Daily Kos. I mean, there's redstate.com, but it gets far, far less traffic and activity. The reason why those are so much smaller is more because of the out-party narrative than it is the ideological narrative. Two simple data points to provide evidence for that. The first is the blogosphere, which throughout the past decade was really led by the American left. You know, before George Bush took office, the proto-blogosphere was led by the Drudge Report. In the 1990s, if you're looking at blog-y types of technologies, it was Drudge, it was FreeRepublic.com, very conservative sites that came up during the Clinton era. And the other thing that we need to note is that if you look across the pond to the UK, in the same years where liberals were dominating the blogosphere here, conservatives were dominating the blogosphere in the UK. And the biggest difference between the two is that here we had the Bush administration giving sites like Daily Kos and MoveOn tremendous material to be mad about. And in the UK, you had the liberals running the government. So there's a sense in which both at the organizational level, it's much easier to raise funds and raise members when you're saying, let's stop the war, than when you're saying, let's pass a healthcare bill that is good enough, though we need to accept some compromises along the way, and we'll discuss that compromise when it happens next week. You know, the complexity of trying to pass something through government rather than trying to stop things in government has always created its own set of incentives.
But that would suggest that Daily Kos would be doing much worse than right-wing equivalent sites, because the right wing is very, very angry about the Obama presidency.
Right. So what we actually find, and this gets into an institution building story, I would say that it is much harder to start a site like Daily Kos for the left in, say, 2009, 2010, than it was in 2002, 2003 when Daily Kos actually started. And we indeed have seen, as soon as Obama took office, we got the Tea Party. And the few areas where the right leads the left online are places like Twitter, which are technologies, internet technologies that ripened, that moved past the early adoption threshold after Obama had taken office. So what we see is this partisan story, the way it ends up working out, is it's not that Obama takes office and the robust community that we find in MoveOn or in Daily Kos suddenly disappears, but it does make it harder to build that community further and to sort of build around the new technologies of the day. And so instead what we saw is lots of Tea Party activism, but not a lot of new MoveOn started. Instead, they got TCOT, top conservative on Twitter, where what they were doing is mastering the newest technologies. Part of what that means, by the way, is depending on how this election works out, I would suggest that one thing we should expect in the future is if we have a Romney presidency, then we'll probably still be telling stories 4 years from now about how liberals dominate the blogosphere and the internet generally. But if we have a second term of Barack Obama, then my guess is we'll start seeing more and more stories about how the old advantage that the left seemed to have 10 years ago has suddenly gone away, and now the right is leading in whatever the newest wave of internet technologies are.
So you thoroughly disagree with what Kos was saying a few years ago, about 4 years ago, I guess, that the reason that we have Daily Kos and we don't have a right-wing equivalent is that liberals are much more comfortable with the open discourse, unmoderated, on a site than conservatives for political and, I guess, maybe psychosocial reasons are.
Yeah, I would weigh against that. I mean, the game that I think we need to play is we need to imagine what it would have been like in 2002, 2003, 2004 if there had been a Gore administration. And my guess is that what we then would have seen is stronger incentives for disaffected conservatives to go online, not only on the Drudge Report and Free Republic, where they're certainly engaging in unmoderated conversation on Free Republic, but to this new wave of technologies that had come out, which was the community blogs. And I think it would have been a lot tougher. I mean, what we see with the founding of Daily Kos, and he's talked about, Marcos has talked about this in his books, is that what motivated him to start founding Daily Kos was disgust with the Democratic Party constantly losing and then voting to approve the Iraq War. That led, and not just disgust with the Democratic Party, but also disgust with existing interest groups that were out there. And so Marcos himself has talked about how he's very critical of the single-issue, siloed organizations that are already there, and he said that it's time to start a new organization. If instead Democrats had been winning and they were in charge, then I think, well, Marcos himself probably would have turned to the blogosphere. I think a lot of the people who were looking for Daily Kos to find a community would have felt less of a need to go find somewhere, and the opposite would also be true.
Is there any truth to the perception that the left is funny and the right isn't?
I think there is truth to that, yes. If I recall correctly, Stephen Colbert once pointed out that comedy requires, it often requires treating the status quo as your straight man. What both Colbert, who's being a pretend conservative, and Stewart and most other comedians are doing is making fun of what's going on in the world today. And given that there's something in conservatism that is saying we must defend the status quo, we must defend those in power, broadly in power, not whoever happens to be in the White House, I would say that that probably does add up to worse comedy. Here I'm probably also displaying a bit of my own partisanship. I was on the board of the Sierra Club for 6 years, and if anybody reads my blog, I'm clearly from the left. But people who know comedy better than me make what I think is a pretty convincing argument that, yeah, there's good reasons why the left is funnier than the right.
In the book, you draw a connection between what's happening to newspapers, their plight, let's say, and what's going on in the advocacy world.
The narrative that I think we've settled on with the newspapers, and a lot of this, again, actually comes from Clay Shirky's work, is that what's hurt the newspapers isn't bloggers. It's Craigslist. It's Google. And in what I mean by that is it isn't direct competition that has harmed newspapers. It's the loss of revenue streams. More people are reading the New York Times, if we count online readers, more people are reading the New York Times than have ever read it before. But we get this move from analog dollars to digital dimes, again, to borrow from Clay. And that means that suddenly the New York Times, they don't have a readership problem, they have a revenue problem. They no longer can so easily pay for that beautiful office space in Midtown Manhattan. And another thing that we've gotten pretty clear on in studying the newspaper world is that for most of us, and certainly for me, I don't mind if newspapers as an archaic form go away. I care specifically about specific types of journalism. If we lose investigative journalism, if we lose local journalism, if we lose international journalism, that's a problem. You know, this is one of the reasons why we've got Berkman projects that are looking into all these things. The problem that we now face for, take investigative journalism, is that the older revenue streams, where you had to go and advertise your classified ads in the newspaper because that was the only game in town, or what Clay Shirky again calls Walmart subsidizing the Baghdad Bureau. That was an inefficient way of advertising. But that inefficiency produced enough extra revenue that we could fund these public goods like investigative journalism. And now that we have more efficient advertising, the social problem we have is how do we pay for the public goods that we're getting paid for in the old way? And I'd actually say in the advocacy space, there's reason to be concerned that we're going to see the same thing. I do expect, based on what we're seeing in this change in membership and fundraising regimes, because it's not just that membership MoveOn defines membership differently, it's also that they fundraise differently. They're mostly sending out fundraisers saying, can you give us $5 to put this commercial on the air about the issue that you saw last night? And what we see from a lot of older advocacy groups is they're taking their old direct mail requests saying, please give us $30 for the year, and they're just putting them online. They're actually using technology in different ways. And the older groups are using it in the old way because They need general revenue that they can use to pay for their big office space. MoveOn.org has 7 million members, about 40 staff, and zero offices. They have just much lower overhead costs, which leaves them better situated in the online environment. But the problem here is that even though I think we're going to lose some older organizations, and that's probably okay in the grand scheme of things, there's certain capacities that the older organizations provided for civil society that I'm not sure we can pay for as well in the new online fundraising world. In particular, to take Wisconsin as an example, the reason why Netroots groups like MoveOn.org very quickly moved to help out their labor allies in Wisconsin is because MoveOn.org, any online organization, is never going to be able to put an organizer there so that they can sit down across the table from management and hammer out a contract. Jobs like long-term community organizers or jobs like trainers who help inculcate laboratory of democracy style skills amongst motivated citizens. Those are capacities that existing advocacy groups have always provided, and I think they're public goods, but they're also very hard to pay for. You can't very effectively send out an online fundraiser saying, "Will you give us $5 to run a training program?" Now you can send it out, but the returns on it are just lousy. And so the one area of concern here is, again, this spectrum of beneficial inefficiencies, that as we get more efficient fundraising in the advocacy space, not only do we get a new generation of organizations, but the niche they fill may leave some capacities out that we as citizens should be concerned leave some public goods underprovided.
In 5 years, where is MoveOn?
That's a good question. In 5 years, I would suspect that MoveOn will still be one of, if not the biggest there is. And the question they're going to face is, how do they adapt to changing circumstances and to changing technologies? When I was writing this book, MoveOn was pretty much just an organization that emailed people. Email they still describe as the killer app. But their webpage was a static webpage, and they didn't do much with it. And right around the time when the book went to press, they, of course, decided to change things, because that's how it happens. I should note, I also sent the book off to press exactly 1 month before Occupy Wall Street started, because, of course, it would start a month after my book on internet organizing gets sent off. What they've since done is modify their webpage. Actually, the people who later started Upworthy.com started out by changing MoveOn's homepage to make it engage much more with content that they thought could and should go viral. And so they've gone ahead and pushed ahead with that. They've also started a site called signon.org, which is kind of like change.org, that allows individual MoveOn supporters or members to start their own petition. And if that petition attracts enough support, then MoveOn will send it out to the broader membership and sort of help it, give it that push and let it go viral. And so they're playing around with, how do they adapt to the new technologies of the day? How do they continue to stay cutting edge? And I'd say in the next 5 years, the way that the organization will change is going to depend on how the internet changes. And the challenge for them is going to be figuring out ways to keep abreast of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Karpf is the author of The MoveOn Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy. He blogs at shoutingloudly.com. You can find out more about David with links to his new book and other work at our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by David Weinberger and me, Daniel Dennis Jones, from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Happy election, everybody.